2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 to 10. Now we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened, because we do not wish to be unclothed, but to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. Now it is God who has made us for this very purpose and has given us the Spirit as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come. Therefore, we are always confident and know that as long as we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. We live by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So we make it our goal to please him, whether we are at home in the body or away from it. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done in the body, whether good or bad.
The great theologian and student of life, Billy Connolly, helpfully explains how wakes began in a recent documentary he's presented. So he finds himself standing in a graveyard at Glasgow, and he's standing in front of a headstone, a big headstone, and the date on it says this person was buried in 18-something, the early 1800s. And it starts him musing. He says, you know, wakes began around about then, and they went for 3 days, and the reason they went for 3 days was to make sure the person was really dead. You wanted to be sure before you put them in the ground. And so this is how wakes began. And then he said, the story goes like this, that there was one wake where when the person was put in a coffin, because the caskets are always open at wakes, in case they are not dead, they can get up and join the party. They're laid out, but the coffin bottom kind of bowed in an unhelpful way, and so the body was kind of pronounced up above the, you know, the lip of the coffin, and so people thought that didn't look good, so they roped the body down. They tied it down so it wouldn't fall out while the dancing and stuff went on. And so the 3 days of dancing and drinking carried on, and during that time, the ropes frayed on the edge of the coffin. And at one point, the ropes snapped, and the body sat upright. And because of the gas that builds up in a human body after death, it sat upright and let out this almighty roar out through its mouth, just roared. The party came to a standstill. People dived out windows, out the door. And as one person was running out the door, their shirt got caught on a nail, and they thought the guy in the coffin was grabbing them. He said, let go, let go, let go. Billy's fascination with death leads to his contemplation of what might be on the other side. What happens next? And it's a poignant documentary for this man. He's now 70. He has prostate cancer. He has Parkinson's. There's no more bounce in Billy's step. It's more like the dragging of feet of Ken's pet grasshopper. I was going to say sisters, but we're being recorded and that would be unhelpful. Anyway, Billy says, I never thought I'd die. No, of course I know I wouldn't live forever, but I thought I wouldn't die. Now, though Billy is slower, his unusual flair and ability to look at life from a particular angle means he explores death and what happens after death with his usual impish fascination. And he helps us, therefore, talk about it. He has a sense that there is something on the other side, that there's a journey that we go on. He tells this story, a true story from Judy Dench's background, where she was walking with her daughter or granddaughter, I cannot remember, and a hearse went by, and the little girl said to Judy, what's that? What's going on? Judy was tired, didn't want to enter into the whole thing of death and funerals, so she said, it's a wedding. To which the little girl responded, "Why are they taking their wardrobe with them?" We're in this series called The Gaining of Wisdom because, as Moses wrote in Psalm 90, he said, "God, teach us to number our days aright, that we might gain a heart of wisdom. Help us understand that our life is mortal, that we might learn to live our life well." As we learn to number our days aright, as we grow in our understanding that we are mortal, then we will turn our eyes to God for the hope of eternity. That is wisdom. And that's because our Creator says to us, the best is yet to come, you know. The best is yet to come. We heard that in the choir's item, but we pick it up also in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16. We'll start here. Paul says, "Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed." And then he says in chapter 5, verse 1, "Now we all know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God." He says our bodies do fail us. Despite Botox, creams and lotions, our bodies do fail us because they are tents. And you know what tents are like, don't you? You've been camping, particularly the canvas ones. We know what tents are like. And particularly in Paul's day, tents would have been quite familiar and may well have been made out of the hide of other beasts. And they all begin really nice, don't they? They're trim, they're taut, and they're terrific. But over time, a tent crinkles and they wrinkle and they get a little thin here and there and they get marks in them and wear holes and they tear. And if they've been in a few rainstorms, particularly the canvas ones, well, they begin to... They smell... Do I need go on? That's the way of all human beings. We walk around in earthly tents. These are temporary bodies. They are good for this life as long as this life lasts. But the best is yet to come. See what Paul says here, 2 Corinthians chapter 5. If our earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God. An eternal house in heaven, not built with human hands. The best is yet to come. There will come a day when our good and great God will give us a new body, one that is by comparison a building, an eternal dwelling. It will not crinkle or wrinkle or waste away. It will be a substantial body, and it will be very impressive. It's so impressive that Paul wrestles with words to try and capture just how great it will be. He moves from talking about us getting a body that will be like a building to talking about us being clothed. You see it in verse 2. "Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling." To be clothed. Our earthly bodies are great clothing for this life, for living and moving about in this environment. But in eternity, we need another set of clothing. Clothing for that environment. You get an idea of what this might look like from a friend of mine who lives in Tasmania, and other friends were visiting them and they were a bit cold because Tasmania, you know, like it's just freezing even in winter, in summer. And so they're visiting Ross in winter and they realised that Ross looked pretty okay. And he said, "Well, that's because I dress for it." Duh. You know, like I have a woolen jumper on, I have an overcoat, I have a scarf, I have hat, I have gloves. I am dressed for this. I am comfortable. If you were dressed like this, you too would be comfortable. You don't walk around in shorts and a t-shirt and thongs in a Tasmanian winter unless you're a prepubescent young Aussie male with no sense. Ross says if you dress appropriately for winter in Tasmania, you will be comfortable. Paul says to us, when we pass away, we will be given a body, a new set of clothing, and we will be comfortable for that environment. And then he says, our body will be swallowed up in life. This new clothing will bring a brilliant transformation. We will be a new man or a new woman. The only thing I can think of to help illustrate this is when I put a wetsuit on for winter to go surfing. It's not made not just for the winter water. It's also made so that I will be protected from the breeze or the wind. So there are extra panels on the chest and on the back. They just protect me from the cold, and I am warm, and it transforms my body. I've just noticed this over the recent while. You put it on, and anything that might be out of place, like anything that might be sagging because the birthday suit's not right, it helps put it in the right place. It gives me posture. It helps bring things into line. The old tent is swallowed up in a feel that I can take on waves. It's like a full body girdle, really, this wetsuit. That's what Paul's talking about here. You will put on a new body and it will transform you. You will be swallowed up, not in death, but in life. There will come a time with our earthly tent will be exchanged for a building of a body that will be full of life, that will never fail us, and we will be comfortable. James Packer, in his book, Finishing Our Course with Joy, says, there will be no sense ever of our reach being extended beyond grasp, or desire outstripping capacity, or weaknesses sabotaging strength. All that is mortal will be swallowed up in life, he says. It will be a perfect body, says Paul. It will be like Jesus' body. In fact, in Philippians chapter 3, verse 21, Paul does say this, that God will transform our lowly bodies so that they will be like Jesus' glorious body. And this is not a ghostly, ephemeral body. Nothing like that. How do we know that? Because when Jesus rose from the dead and appeared to his disciples, and they're scared witless, he says, why are you troubled, in Luke 24? Look at my hands. Look at my feet. It is me, myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I do. And then he ate a meal with them. We will have a new body with which we can touch the world in which we will then live. It's just as well we have this assurance that we'll have a body that is like Jesus. Otherwise, the mathematicians would take over. You know what they're like. They think in perfect numbers, perfect shapes. And for mathematicians, a perfect shape is a sphere. And so if we go with the mathematicians, they say that we will have a spherical body. And then some of them are rude enough to say some of us are well on the way to getting that. This is not what their future is. You see, as good as life is here in the hills, this is not it. The best is yet to come. And the more we realize that, the greater our wisdom. We will not become so attached to this world that we cannot leave it behind, but rather we will look forward to the time that is to come, to living in the very presence of God, to see the face of Him who loved us so, to enjoy the community of the Trinity that is marked by a never-ending giving and receiving of self-sacrificial love. And of course, the question is, yes, but what happens at death? Like, do we get our body then? Or, like, how does it play out? Well, in summary, the New Testament's teaching is, if we die before Jesus returns, we will shed this mortal coil, but we will not receive our new body then. We will be, as it says in verse 3, as though naked. That is, without clothing, without this earthly tent, and without the body that is to come. But we'll not be in some kind of limbo state. We will still be before our God. And we get that sense in chapter 5, verse 6 through 8, where Paul writes, therefore, we're always confident and know that as long as we are at home in the body, that is, in our earthly tent, we are away from the Lord. We live by faith here, not by sight. He says, but we are confident, I say, and I would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. He's saying, I'd rather be with Jesus, even though I would be naked without a new body, than to be in this body, he says. I would rather be with Jesus than here, he says. And then he says in chapter 5, verse 2, in the meantime, we groan. We groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling. We groan, he says. We groan because our bodies are like old grasshoppers dragging back legs along. We long for a new body. We don't want to be found naked, and so we groan at the thought that we will be without an earthly tent, without our heavenly body, and naked before God. Even though we're before God, we would rather have a new body, for who wants to be found naked? And we groan with a hopeful longing that there is a new body to come, the one that looks just like Jesus' body, and that will be given to anybody who follows Jesus. And we long for that because we know the best is to come. This is the groaning of a woman in childbirth. There is pain now, but their best is yet to come. Some might say, well, how can you be so confident? You know, we've only had one person who's been really dead, like really dead, that they came back and told us about that with a resurrection body, and that is Jesus. And that resurrection rate's not very high. It's one in about 105 billion deaths. There's not a lot of, you know, not a lot of weight behind this. Well, I'm confident because Jesus did die. He was dead. But he came back with a resurrection body. And the Bible tells us he is the first fruits because he rose from the dead. Everybody who follows Jesus now will also rise from the dead. He guarantees that this is true. And we who follow Christ have known him. We have known him to be trustworthy. We've known that he does forgive sin. He takes away the burden of the sin. He takes away the guilt of our sin. We have spoken with him. We have listened to him. We have enjoyed his comfort, his solace, his guiding hand. We know him. He is a trusted friend. When we die, we will go on a journey, therefore, to a land that we do not know, but we will go with a trusted friend. About 25 years ago, a friend of mine called Mark said, do you want to go caving? I said, what, the Jenolan Caves? He said, no, caving. That means getting down and getting dirty and crawling through dark places, no lights except what's on your head. And I'll take you to this magical wonderland underground where there's a river and a waterfall. Do you want to go that? I said, I'm in. We drove for hours to some paddock in the middle of New South Wales somewhere, and he found a hole. How he found this hole in the middle of this paddock, it still defies me. We got into the hole, and he just threw a kind of a rope ladder down, and we scampered down the rope ladder. It was totally dark. We abseiled into pitch black holes, even over ledges. So he'd go down first and say, no, you put your foot a little bit to the right as you abseil down this one. I'm thinking, to your right? Why do you have to go to the right? Don't worry about that. Just put your feet to the right. There was drops that were meters long into deep black holes. Why did I do this? Because I was with a trusted friend who'd been there before. And when we got down to the bottom of this cave, he was right. We started walking in an ankle-deep creek. Then it got knee-deep. It turned into a stream, and then it became a river, and it flowed out into this pool, which came down at the bottom of a waterfall. We swam out into this pool, under the waterfall, sat on its rocks. It was a wonderland underground playground, a place in the earth completely foreign to me. But I enjoyed it because a trusted friend took me there. When we die, a trusted friend will take us to an unknown land. And what is more, Paul says here in verse 5, God has given us the Spirit of himself as a guarantee that we will go there. God has placed this longing for the future in us and has given us his Spirit as a deposit to guarantee that the best is yet to come. Death, then, is, as Billy Connolly suggests in his documentary, it's a big send-off. It's not the end. It's a big send-off. And for the Christian, the send-off is from this life and this earthly tent to stand before God with a brand spanking new body that will not wear out or fade and will be swallowed up in life. And my friends, this impacts two areas of our current life, as Paul says. And I need to put them this way. It means that we die well, and it means that we live well. We die well because we know that the best is yet to come. This is not the end. Death is a doorway to the next chapter of a Christ follower's life. To be sure, there is a question I think that comes up, that is the Jesus that I've served for 10, 20, 30, 70 years, is he faithful enough? Is he someone that I can trust enough? Is he strong enough to take me through death's door? That is a reasonable question. But he is more than able to deliver on that. Remember when the disciples got a bit anxious because he was going to die and leave them? He said in John 14, "Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust in me. In my Father's house there are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come back and I will take you to be with me, that you may be with me where I am." I have sat with a few people over the years as they've prepared to pass away. I have sat with people who have died well. There is sadness, of course, because with their passing means that they leave loved ones. And there's still more to do, isn't there? There's always more to do. But there is also a deep joy and anticipation. Because when they passed, they knew that their trusted friend Jesus, someone they had trusted for maybe half a century or more, would be there to meet them, and they would see the face of him who loved them so. Such men and women die well. One of my heroes is Richard Baxter, a Puritan from the 1500s in England. His life was marked with things like gout and other irritating illnesses. When it came time for him to pass away and the doctor said, "Get your things in order, for you will die soon, like in the next 24 hours. He got so excited, he lived for another 2 weeks. That is to die well. The Christian has great confidence that the best is yet to come, and so we can die well. If you are not confident yet, if there is some anxiety about this, if this is an uncomfortable series, please keep talking to us. Because we want you to finish the race well, so that you might know to the depth of your being that you will stand with God. So die well, and secondly, live well. Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9 and 10, "So in the light of all of this, we make it our goal to please God, whether we're home in the body or away from it, for we all must appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due to him for the things done while in this body, whether good or bad." Jim Packer, again in his book Finishing Our Course Well, says, "The quality of our unending enjoyment of Christ's love and goodness will correspond to the quality of love and devotion to him that marks our lives now. We will experience his love and joy, and now we must live well, a life of love and devotion." And so I want to encourage you to keep plugging away for Jesus. Keep doing things like primetime, like wasn't that a hoot last week? 410 women heard the gospel being spoken to them in an environment that made sense to them. Keep plugging away at that. Keep praying for people, your children, your grandchildren. Keep encouraging one another so that no one loses heart or is tempted to turn away from Jesus in this, the last leg of your race. Keep in doing all of this. And there is one other area, if I may be so bold, that you and only you can make a contribution in. Only you. You are the elders who have so much to offer this church. You are the elders. You've walked with Christ again perhaps 40, 50, or even 70 years. You have spoken to the living God. You have listened to the living God. You have learnt to trust him in the darkest of days, and you have rejoiced in his presence. All this makes you elders for every generation that is following you. Those in their 60s, those in their 50s, even those in their teens and their 20s. One of my fondest memories from 40 years, every time I think about this, I think I need a Bex and a good lie down. 40 years, can you really, like 40 years. 40 years ago, I was sitting in the front row on the right-hand side of the pews in the old St. Paul's, right under the pulpit. Because I sat there, I sat next to an older man called Canon Arrowsmith. I was a wet behind the age teenage Christian. I cannot remember a word of what he said to me, but I can remember his warm smile and his interest in me. And I knew that I was in the presence of one who had been in the very presence of God. He was a gracious man, and I recall thinking, I would like to be like him. Sometimes I meet older brothers and sisters, and I do not think such thoughts. I think they're cranky and critical and cantankerous. But with Canon Arrowsmith, or Archbishop Harry Goodhue, is now in his mid-80s, I have a sense that I'm in the presence of those who have been in the very presence of God, and they are very attractive men. I always learn more from them. Such elders leave their mark, and in my case, for 40 years. I want to be like those men. I know the music of the generation that is coming up is not to my taste. It's not. I'm 55. The 5 o'clock, it's not to my taste. But I rejoice in that because the next generation is hearing the gospel in their medium. When my ears get so sensitive that I will not like the sound, I want to be like another 84-year-old woman I heard of in her church. She would go along and the minister said, I've just noticed you keep coming to this service. It's, you know, rock and roll. It's kind of, you know. She said, oh, no, I love coming. Why do you like coming? I love the people. Isn't the music too loud? That's why I wear these. You have so much wisdom to share to hungry generations who follow you. Somehow, you have to work out how to share your wisdom with them. Maybe it's with your children, your grandchildren, even your great-grandchildren. It might be with the 1,000 other people who will come into this building today by coming to their services. As we gain wisdom for the last leg of the race, may you set yourselves to die well and to live well. May your prayer be that of King David in Psalm 71. Even when I'm old and grey, do not forsake me, my God, till I declare your power to the next generation, your mighty acts to all those who are to come.